Dan, how's it going?
I am doing just ducky. We got only four more days of school, or three, depending on who's counting.
Right. Yeah, I'm looking forward to summer as well. I think remote learning has been difficult for teachers and students, and especially teachers who have students of their own living in their house with them.
Yeah, it's kind of been a little bit of like trickle-down education.
I guess you could say that.
Yeah, I just did.
Welcome back, everyone, to Trickle Down Socialism, where we discuss how the U.S. currently has a system of socialism for the super rich and corporations, where we try to defang the term and explore how government, with just a slight tweak in priorities, could be a force for good in all of our lives.
Yeah, so I know you have an awesome interview lined up today, Pat. Who's coming on the show?
Yeah, so we were lucky enough to have a conversation with City Councilor Lydia Edwards, who represents East Boston, Charlestown, and the North End. And she basically explained to me how city government works. So I asked her about defunding the police and about her work to try to protect working class families and make sure that they don't get priced out of where they're living in Boston currently. She is fighting the good fight, and she also is able to explain pretty clearly how these things work within the city council.
So it sounds like she gave the civics teacher a little civics lesson.
She did. She took me to school on how city government works. So I was
now you're ready to take the MTEL.
Yeah, actually, I already passed that one, but that's all right.
So okay. Before we do that, we have some callers. We have some friends of the pod who have called in, right?
Yeah, we picked the three best callers, and I'm really excited to play back what they shared with us.
So you want to play the first one?
Yeah, let's go ahead and play the first one now.
Hi, my name is Frances. I'm calling currently from Somerville. Just wanted to share a little bit of my opinion on how the media is portraying the protest. So I think a lot of what's been going around on the media has been really negative about the protests and really has lost its focus on the reason behind folks of color protesting and really having those white allies going out to protest. I think the other thing that I've noticed also is not only have we lost the point of these protests, which is to ensure that Black Lives Matter and that everybody around the world knows that we're fighting for human rights, basic rights of those who identify as Black. But we've also seen in media that they're portraying the negative sides to protesting, which oftentimes is these acts of quote-unquote violence are not necessarily done by Black folk, but instead by other people of color or white folks who are there to, you know, do whatever they think is best with regards to protesting. So the media has only been focusing on those people, like tagging the walls, you know, going in and out of businesses and breaking windows, et cetera, and they're no longer focusing on the actual peaceful protests that are happening and taking place, which is the biggest, honestly. There's not a lot of violence actually taking place at these protests. I've already attended, I believe, three of them, and not once did I see anything that would have been considered violent. On the contrary, they were all very peaceful. One of them, until the very end, which is when police actually came in and started initiating a lot of things, was when it got out of control. And I think that is also another thing that hasn't been shown in the media, what the police has been doing that has caused for these protests that are peaceful to get out of control, get out of hand. So a lot of what's been going around in the media has definitely been focused on the negative aspect of protests, and at this point is once again shining a light on all of these stereotypes, and instead of making things better and really showing that protests can be peaceful and that we can continue to work together to fight for basic human rights for Black folks, a lot of what's taking place right now is once again putting those stereotypes on Black people, when a lot of times it's not even them causing the issues that are arising in these protests.
What stood out to me, Pat, in listening to Francis talk about how the media is portraying things is how quickly the narrative devolved from what was a peaceful protest in many cities. You know, I know some were not. How it quickly devolved into whatever rioting or looting there was became the narrative really quickly.
No, I'm in full agreement. I think there's a kind of a line that they use in journalism, which is if it bleeds, it leads. So violence and gore make the front page and kind of sell ads for the corporate media. And so I think that's why we've seen, you know, so much of the violence that has happened in very isolated pockets being held up as like a representation of the protests themselves.
Mm-hmm. And I think our next caller talks about the types of media outlets and how different outlets cover the stories in a more focused way.
Yeah, I think he's mindful about where he gets his media. So let's go ahead and cue up Dan.
Dan and Pat, what's up? Dan Rosenfeld. I've been seeing a lot of solid news coverage of the protests and Black Lives Matter movements and Black-run news sources. From a global perspective, Al Jazeera English has been doing well. And then from a local perspective, I met a man named Yahoo Miller at the Teachers Union earlier this year. He publishes the city's longest-running Black newspaper, the Bay State Banner. Local very well. And Dan, your friend Nate called Candace Owens a house N-word, opposing ideas like she and those like her Harper, is a long-running, really deep, informative, like very personal blog written by a Philadelphia lawyer who's a Black man just writing his heart out about race relations in the United States. And it's called The Field N-word. I'm not going to say it, but it's Field N-E-G-R-O. And I highly recommend it. The banner across his blog reads, "Silence is never golden." Such an important message. Also, don't read the comments on that blog unless you really brace yourself. Overall, I certainly still have some questions about the protest coverage in general. I was thinking, like, are some news agencies just over-reporting the part of the story focusing on the looting and the burning, and then under-reporting analysis and opinion pieces on the why that happens? Also, I checked out the New York Times this morning from my phone. They had a coronavirus map with all the red dot hotspots, and literally right underneath it, another map of protests, also with red dots, and a sub-headline reading, "See how the movement spread," honestly making it seem like a virus with a very negative connotation. I thought they would know better. Anyways, I was just balancing out my news diet with some trickle-down socialism. You guys are awesome. Be well.
So Rosenfeld has been a friend of ours for quite a while. Dan, what struck you about what he said?
Well, I think he's choosing to get media that speaks from the perspective of communities of color. And I think what's unfortunate about big media outlets, you know, let's say a CNN or MSNBC or Fox, you know, even regardless of if you're a liberal or conservative, they are trying to get as many listeners as possible, right? So that they can sell advertising. And their priority is not ensuring justice for communities of color, right? So I think you shouldn't consume media that doesn't match your values, right? So if you're just trying to see how many people died from coronavirus today, you can probably get that information anywhere. But if you are genuinely like a white ally or white accomplice or someone in a community of color, you have to be very careful about how you choose your media.
Yeah, I think that's a great summary of what Rosenfeld is doing there and what he's sharing with us there.
Hey, Pat, you have a third caller for us?
Yeah, so we're going to go ahead and listen to a caller. I think she might be a friend of yours, named Dara White, calling from North Carolina.
Hey, Dan and Pat. This is Dara White calling in from Durham, North Carolina. You know, I would say what's interesting where I live in Durham is that we're part of an area called the Triangle, which includes Durham, Raleigh, and Chapel Hill. And usually Durham is always kind of the redheaded stepchild, right? It always, if there's crime, it's in Durham. If there was a shooting, it was in Durham. Durham's always, always in the view for negative press. What's been really interesting to watch is that Durham has actually been portrayed, I feel like, really positively in the press in relationship to the peaceful protests, and that's in large part to our law enforcement leadership and them standing with the protesters and making the protesters feel like they will be left alone so long as they stay peaceful. And I think, you know, it sounds very basic, but that really has proven to make a big difference, and Raleigh has not been quite as fortunate. I did attend a peaceful march in Chapel Hill, and I would say the press covered that almost, it was almost like it was just no big deal. Like, people walked today, and it was great. Anyways, so those are my thoughts from down here in North Carolina. Thanks so much for a great show, you guys. Always look forward to hearing what topics y'all will be covering next.
Yeah, so, Pat, it sounded like Dara was talking about the disparity between Raleigh-Durham are kind of like twin cities in a way, a smaller version of like Minneapolis and St. Paul. And it seems like there's been a disparity in how police have approached the two communities.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. And I really appreciate all three of these folks taking the time to call in and share, you know, the way that they've been consuming media, the way that the media has been portraying the protests. You know, I think I learned a lot from those three perspectives.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to involving people more in the future. Each of the participants today is going to receive a special gift, and it's related to this movement. I have some I Can't Breathe masks, and I also made some 8 Can't Wait bumper stickers, which is something we can get into in a future episode. But I still have plenty left, Pat, so we may have to get some more callers in the next few episodes.
Yeah, those the phone number will be in the episode notes for each episode, so folks can always call in with a comment, and we'll make a choice whether we play that in the next episode. So our next segment here is going to be the interview that I did with City Councilor Edwards. And then I want to invite folks to stick around. My buddy Carlos, who goes by the DJ name Arc5 now, put together a really cool compilation about the protests and about George Floyd's death. It contains audio from both Reverend Al Sharpton and Cornell West. And the beat was put together by Dito 22. They're part of a rap group called Phonetics. But let's go ahead and have a listen to the interview, followed by the track put together by Arc5.
Sounds good.
Good morning, and welcome to Trickle Down Socialism, a show founded by Boston Public School educators to discuss government priorities and how to make sure the government is working for all of us. So you're the city councilor representing the school where Dan and I work, and so we're super excited to have you for that reason and many others. But before we talk about your work on the city council, could you briefly tell us a bit about your backstory? Where'd you grow up? How'd you get on the city council?
Sure. I am an Air Force brat. My mother was in the military. And so we bounced around and ultimately graduated from school in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And then I came out east to go to Marymount College. It was a women's college. It's now part of Fordham University. Went to law school after that, and then was happily going to try and make money to make sure my mom didn't have to work two jobs anymore. Got into a big law firm, and the recession hit. And as a result, I ended up getting into volunteering at an immigrant worker center, and that changed my life. I learned Portuguese. I learned Spanish. I learned what organizing really meant. I understood the multiple layers of oppression for being an undocumented woman, person of color, at levels I didn't know before. And I went on to just continue into legal services, work really hard representing folks, pushed for the Domestic Worker Bill of Rights, helped to write the law, push for it, lobby for it, and it passed. And that got me into politics. I ran for in a special election for Senate for the East Boston. I lost. And then the next year, the city council seat opened up and I ran again. So just reminding people, it takes more than one shot.
Yeah.
Okay. So run for office and run as many times as you need to if you really feel that your voice and those of the people who you love are not represented.
I love that message. I have a lot of students over the years who have faced the challenges you described there. And, you know, being undocumented is definitely one of them. And I think Boston's a great place for them to be. But I'm really glad to hear that you have that experience on the city council and that you're advocating for some of those folks. That's a really cool backstory. Thanks for sharing that. So I want to start with your recent call for a little more transparency from the Boston Planning and Development Agency. You've asked for documentation. What are you hoping to find? What are you looking for there?
I'm hoping to see what they actually are doing and how they consider all Bostonians, vulnerable classes of individuals, families, people with disabilities, folks who are historically discriminated against for ethnicity, for race. I want to know how they are planned for. And the best way to do that is to get it from their direct emails, from their documents, from how they talk about it. Because I truly believe you don't actually fix a problem by avoiding talking about it. And I want to know for sure, and I want to see for sure how they're doing that work. And if I don't see that, then I am particularly going to be demanding that they change the law and the zoning code to make sure that they have those conversations.
Do you have any examples or any issues that you've seen already that kind of pressed you to do this of equity in projects that have been completed? Like, what tipped you off to dig in here?
Look at East Boston's waterfront. All right. That was developed since I've been here. It was nothing before and then became monstrosities on the waterfront. And I would argue that it doesn't represent our beautiful diversity in terms of income level or in terms of ethnicity. I would argue that it caters for and two, and is in encouraging only people of a lot of means to come in and live in that building and those buildings. And that's frustrating to me. That doesn't represent us. And it also, whether they don't have a fence up, but they are saying to a lot of folks in East Boston, you're not welcome.
Wow.
And so when you see that on a regular basis, I run by there almost on a daily basis when I take my run from the airport to the Hyatt, airport T station to the Hyatt, that's my route. And I see that and I'm perpetually reminded that we allowed this to happen on its own terms. And I'm not satisfied. And so then I think about Suffolk Downs, which is the single largest private development in Boston's history. I'll repeat that again. Suffolk Downs is the single largest private development in Boston's history. It is between East Boston and Revere, and it'll be 10,000 housing units. And it's nothing there right now. And I am inspired by the fact that we have so many lessons that people have fought for, laid their lives, laid their bodies down and their lives down to make sure that we could be in the opportunity to have the opportunity to plan for a better world, a better neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And so I'm demanding that we have rules and regulations that force our planners to do that.
What are some ways we can ensure? Do you support measures like, for instance, rent control? Or, you know, what are the ways that we can make sure that working class folks aren't pushed out like you're already describing?
I would say rent control or forms of rent control, subsidies, all of these things are helpful, but they're not getting at the root cause. Because if we were to have rent control tomorrow, it would freeze us at the rents that we have. The issue is that we don't get paid enough.
Yeah.
People literally are choosing not to go back to work because they get more money from help from the government for a bad economy than they do actually going to work that 9 to 5.
Right.
right?
Yeah.
So if you froze that person's rent tomorrow, and this economy, or they didn't have the help, they wouldn't be able to afford it, period. We need fundamental structural and total overhaul of how we pay people, number one. And then you look at the ways in which we've allowed people to exploit this market and go too far. And so I would argue a lot of the advocates are pushing for more rent stabilization than rent control.
Sure.
And stabilization methods that make sense to me are capping how much you can increase rent on per month or per lease change. I think Oregon might be at 7%. You can't go higher than 7% or maybe more per year. I've talked to developers who are in it for the money, and they said they would never even consider an increase over 6% because it's too aggressive. And what we're seeing in East Boston is people's rents doubling the next month.
Wow.
And so we're seeing 100%. So I personally think that that should be capped, how much you can increase over the next month over somebody. I mean, it's I don't know. I mean, there are some people who don't just want complete and total autonomy and believe that the market should do what it's supposed to do. I don't believe the market should be able to do that, period. So that's what I would say to, you know, what we could be doing, rent stabilization measures, and we can come up with the right percentage that makes sense, right?
Yeah.
We can come up with, we plan on having an actual city voucher, which is huge, because a city voucher would be funded by the city of Boston. So who gets access to that money, regardless of immigration status? We can go higher in terms of income, because a lot of people, you know, the federal government, for many of us, it's too low.
Yes.
There are a lot of people struggling who are in that middle category,
yep,
who absolutely need help. So we can go higher than them. So I believe that we can structure that in a way, but I don't want to just supplement and support big developers making as much money as possible, except now they're making it for the tenant and from the city of Boston. Makes sense?
Yeah.
I think we need to also look at linkage and how we extract money from developers and increase that. Linkage is the square footage amount they pay for not building residential when they build commercial. And right now it's at $9 for residential and $1 for our jobs trust. Wow. And we have pending at the State House the ability for the first time to take that dial into Boston's hands and be able to turn it up or turn it down based on what we deem as appropriate. So that would be huge.
Yeah. Yeah. So my first job out of college was housing advocacy in Framingham. I helped homeless families get into sustainable housing. And the news that you just shared about working towards a city voucher is just enormous. I want to just switch gears to kind of speak to the moment we're in right now as a country. And I think Boston's experiencing this as well, and talk about, you know, the calls to defund the police. Now, I think a lot of people are confused by the term defund. It's not calling for, you know, abolition of police. It's reallocating resources in order to make sure that the situation is met with the personnel who can best handle that situation. I've been encouraged by how widespread those calls have been. The Boston Teachers Union recently approved a resolution to ask the city to take police out of schools. And personally, as a teacher, I've seen many instances where a student is having a problem, and when the school police officer is called in, it escalates the situation just because of whatever built-in trauma that one student has around police. The police are usually around in pretty negative moments of their life. And so I'm fully supportive of that resolution. But what's your position on police in Boston schools?
I think the police are tired of also being called to do things that they are not qualified to do, and also have to do with mental health and emotional stability. That is not their job. And I think that because of the sensitive nature of this valuable resource, our children, our babies, we need to make sure that when we call in for backup, it is backup to bring that child to the best health that they need to be in. And I don't think right now our police officers are trained to do that, or that we assume that that's what they're called in, or that they assume that's what they're called in to do. I think, therefore, I do believe sometimes teachers need backup because they're also called to do a lot more, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
But it's one thing to have a police officer, and then one thing to have a public safety expert in child development who's readily available to de-escalate.
Yeah.
And I don't know either the police are going to become in that field, or we're going to have to just simply remove them and get somebody else in there who is in that field. I understand when there's two different conversations about safety too in schools now. You, I mean, there's the one where the child is having a moment because of whatever they are dealing with in their home life, or something they're triggered in, or they're not diagnosed with whatever special needs or other issues that they have. Okay, that's one thing. Never do I think a police should be responding to that.
Right.
The other one is the literal reality we're in right now with school shootings.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's a different call, and I absolutely want the police to respond to that.
Yep. I think you really understand what we as teachers see, and that's that, you know, we want a social worker or a mental health counselor to respond if the kid needs to have some therapy in the moment, or have someone who understands what's going to get that person to the best health. That was a great way of describing it.
It is. And I think we assume the teacher is supposed to be able to manage a class of 20 to 30 students and also do that at the same time, which is not fair.
Well, I appreciate
it's, that. It's not fair. No. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't even, I forgot you guys were teachers, but I think that's not fair. To assume that they should do that. So I think the school should be equipped with resources, public safety, emotional, mental health, collaborators, if you want to get rid of the word officer, that they should be present. We should be paying for that. If that is coming from the BPD's budget, then I'm not upset about that. But I don't think officers necessarily need to be there. I think these public safety professionals need to be there.
Right. Okay. So the mayor has answered these calls to defund the police by announcing $3 million will be reallocated from the police overtime budget. Now, I know this is super complicated. There are like four different unions that need to be, you know, bargained with and all kinds of stuff. But from what I've seen from my vantage point, now, I don't have any insider knowledge on any of the budgets, but I've seen the full city budget is closer to $3 billion, and that the city spends about a little more than $400 million on police. Is $3 million out of the overtime budget enough?
So I want to just clarify that the total number that he is segmenting or reallocating is $12 million from the overtime budget.
Okay.
$2 million of which is staying in the BPD. So the other $10 million is going to housing, is going to fund the his new or Ricardo Arroyo's call for racism being a public health crisis. The mayor recently agreed with that call and said he'll not only meet it, but also set up a commission that deals with that, which is great.
Yeah.
So he's putting money into that. So we have housing, we have mental health, we have I think the BEST team, which is actually on the BPD. So we're allocating $10 million out of the BPD and $2 million within the BPD towards mental health services and other social services that we need to absolutely happen. The Human Rights Commission, all of these different resources. So that's a good thing. And there's a commitment on top of that, that those particular departments that are getting this extra money will not be at all impacted with reduction in funds in our budget. That was key. We didn't want them to get $1 million for us to then cut $1 million, right?
Right.
Because of COVID. All yeah. right. So that's one thing. The other thing is when it comes to overtime, and people need to understand that you're in a union, I'm in a union, right? They're contracted, right? Oh, I don't know. Maybe you are not in BTU. I'm
no,
sorry.
I am.
If you.
Yes,
okay.
I am.
Okay. I'm not sure. I made that assumption. But your overtime rights are separate from the city budget.
Yeah.
Your overtime rights are fiercely negotiated by your union against the city.
Yeah.
And then the city enters into a separate contract. So your overtime rights or the police officer's overtime rights happen regardless of what that budget number is. All right. So that's what a lot of folks need to understand.
Yeah.
So where we need to negotiate and where we need to look at is at the collective bargaining overtime contract, not just in this budget moment. So that the mayor probably, he just can't walk in there and undo the contractual rights of workers.
Sure.
Nor would I want him to. So that's where I am right now. I think he took what he could take right now. Without going too far, but I do want to make sure people understand he could take it all. They still have a contractual right and they could earn it all. And then we'd still have to pay it all, but it would come from our libraries. It would come from our schools. It would come from other parts.
Okay. Okay. Thank you for clarifying.
It was a long explanation, but a lot of folks, and in terms of defund the police, you know, I've heard different understandings of that. Some people are like, no, I absolutely want to abolish the police. And majority simply want the reallocation and understanding that investing in other places actually will end up reducing the budget anyway, which I agree. You invest more in mental health and addiction services. You invest more in social and emotional well-being of our children. You invest in that now at levels that have been historically low, but make them extremely high. I think that it overall reduces the need for policing our way out of those societal health issues.
Sure. Absolutely. That is a super, detailed answer. And I appreciate you clarifying the numbers too, because what I've seen is that $3 million number, and you really like flesh it out in a way that makes a lot more sense than the news coverage that I've been able to glean from it. So I do appreciate that. In terms of like a how the city council works question, and this is something I teach, I'm a civics teacher for eighth graders. And
awesome.
So how much influence.
I'm wondering why I haven't been at your class yet then. Okay. I mean, really?
No, this we're
I speak Spanish too.
Year.
It's been three languages okay. I speak. Oh.
That's done. That's a done deal. I brought them to the state house and stuff. You're coming in as soon as COVID is under control and I can get you in the
awesome.
Classroom.
Awesome.
I would love that. And also representation for my kids is so huge for them to see people of color in positions of power is just enormous. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us how much, the city council has to do with the budget? Like, is it, what's the power share there between the mayor and the city council over budgeting issues?
Not much. It's nowhere near what it should be if you really want the legislative branch to be a check on the executive branch. We can look at and suggest some reductions, but it's not line item. Like we can't simply go to the overtime budget and say, come down. It's the police budget in a huge bucket, that we have to, and that's harder to break down. We basically can vote up or down on the budget, right?
Yes.
And there's three major buckets that we have. We have capital, which is for special projects one time, like a park. We have the school budget, which is one third of our $3 billion. $1 billion is just for BPS.
Yep.
And the school committee has more impact over that than I think the city council.
Right.
We can talk about elected school committee another day. And then there's the operating budget, which is like basically salaries.
Okay.
And so with those major buckets, it's up or down and looking at how, we can go back and forth and try and negotiate, but it's really limited our power and scope. I certainly am for a charter reform that gives the city council way more power on budget. A lot of stuff, I know.
No. This is all really important for people to understand. I don't think it's as transparent. And I also don't think, civics is not taught as widely. We're starting to get back there, and we have a state law that makes civics a reality for eighth graders across the state, which I think is fantastic. But I think that just a basic understanding of how our government works in Boston is not as widely known as it should be. So that's why we're doing this. This is, what we're trying to do in this podcast, among other things. But I really appreciate you taking the time. We've already gone over the time that I asked you to give me. So I want to say thank you from Dan and from me for taking the time to talk to us.
Mm-hmm.
I want to encourage you to keep the fight going that you just described to us, fighting for equity, fighting for transparency, and fighting for the working class residents of Boston.
Well, thank you so much. I'm honored to be on here, and I want to thank you guys as teachers and as folks who are amplifying, a message of what good government should look like. It's important that people are reminded it isn't just tearing it down. It's how we build up and allocate that really have the rubber meet the road. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Genesis 2 said that God formed man, and Jamie, they say he breathed breath, the breath of life, to make him a live human being, which means that breath comes from God. Breath is how God gives you life. Breath is not some coincidental kind of thing that happens. Breath is a divine decision that God made. Some babies are born stillborn. God decides to blow breath in them. Breath is sanctified. Breath is sacred. You don't have the right to take God's breath out of anybody. minutes and 46 seconds. 46 seconds. 8 minutes. Venom. 46 seconds. 8 minutes and 46 seconds. 46 seconds. 8 minutes. Venom. 46 seconds. If you had any idea that everybody from those in the third world to those in Hollywood would show up in Houston and Minneapolis and in Fayetteville, North Carolina, you'd have took your knee off his neck. If you had any idea that preachers, white and black, was going to line up in a pandemic when we told to stay inside and we come out and march in the streets at the risk of our health, you'd have took your knee off his neck.
That's a grand gift to the world, right in the bowels, at the center of an American empire that has enslaved, Jim Crow, Jane Crow, lynched them, still dishing out these love boys. You can put us down, but you're not gonna put us down in such a way that we gonna hate you because you become the point of reference. White supremacy may make you black a crime, but we refuse to get in the gutter. We gonna go down swinging like Ella Fitzgerald, Muhammad Ali, in the name of love and justice. This is a matter of integrity and honesty, a matter of justice.